Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out on a Friday night. It's the weekend of the Tucson Book Festival, so I'm excited that you're here.
Thank you so much.
And I'm excited that Candace is here. Obviously, this is her first visit to the Poison Pen, and she is, you can tell, Australian.
I am.
You are.
Through and through.
However, I have just actually written to some of our we have a sort of newsletter we send out to some of our bigger buyers, and I'm always being asked, what's the next big thing? And the next big thing, at least in crime, is an Australian crime wave.
Oh.
The Scandinavian is kind of, you know, for a long time, that was just everything that was ever written in any Scandinavian language was translated into English and, you know, published. But now I think we're seeing Australia. For a while, we had more romantic authors or women's fiction. We had Kate Morton, who I think is fabulous.
Yes.
And am I right that Leanne Moriarty is, she's Australian, isn't she?
Yes, I believe she is. She at least lives there. I think she's Aussie. Yeah.
I think
we'll claim her anyway.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then we've had some established historical crime fiction authors from Australia. Poison Pen Press actually publishes Carrie Greenwood in the Miss Fisher Mysteries.
Fantastic.
See, I didn't know you knew that, which my husband refers to as costume porn. If you've ever watched any of Essie Davis in her fabulous outfits, you could really see that. And then Sulari Gentle, and
yes,
she also,
I know Sulari, yeah.
Aren't they
she's
wonderful
lovely.
Books?
Yeah, yeah.
And we publish.
She's a lovely person.
She is a lovely person,
well, yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we publish her as well. She's actually, I think, Sri Lankan by heritage, but lives in Australia and is a lawyer. But she writes, she's like Jackie Winspear. It's the same era, but it's a down under. So until I read her, I never really thought about what was going on with fascists and communists and so forth in your country, because our focus is really on Europe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, we have a rich history, and it's so good to know that authors are covering that period. I mean, she's the one that I think of, you know, for that. I've run into her. I seem to run into her at every single writers' festival. I'm like, hey, there's a cool crew of Australian crime writers. And a couple of months ago, we were actually bandying about different titles, you know, because they say Scando Noir, you know, for the Scandinavian thing. What were we going to call the Aussie crime wave if it happened? I think the closest we got was Dingo Noir, but I don't think we settled on that. It was just sort of a Twitter conversation.
Maybe Aussie Noir would really be better. Oz has a certain magical ring to it.
Yeah, exactly.
It really does. And then there's been a lot of what I would describe as like Cormac McCarthy rather than Agatha Christie crime fiction from Australia. Gary Disher, who writes really interesting books set on a peninsula, that area below Melbourne, which is where Carrie lives. And Jane Harper, who recently, you know, came to the fore with The Dry, and now Force of Nature set in the outback.
In the mountains.
And Paul Howarth, who's just written an historical set in the outback.
I started writing crime fiction set in Australia because I'd been reading some Peter Temple,
Temple, yes,
he
I have.
He just taught me so much about dialogue, and in particular how men talk. After I'd read some Peter Temple, I started writing scenes and going back and cutting the men's dialogue in half, because it just men don't talk as much
as women
do, you know, or they don't use as many words, and it just was so much more effective the way that he'd done it on the page.
He's a very talented writer. Never has taken off in the United States as much as he might have. And then we have two authors who've written a lot of British crime fiction, one of whom, both of them actually, I'm extremely fond of, Barry Maitland and Michael Robotham, who live in Australia and have written lots of British crime but are now writing Australian crime, which is fabulous.
Yeah.
And then we had Sarah Bailey, who was here at the end of October, and she's a gal who's written a kind of trust no one, sort of a police procedural set in Australia, and now we have Candace, so I'm expecting to see even more. When I was in New Zealand in January, New Zealand has not got as much in the way of Native New Zealanders writing, but they're coming on. And there are quite a few very, very good ones. So,
right.
You know, Americans tend to think of down unders, including New Zealand.
Yes,
but it really doesn't.
I hear a lot of people say, oh, where are you from? Australia. Oh, I know somebody who lives in New Zealand.
Right.
Oh, okay. That's great. They're our buddies.
Well, very true, but it's at least a 3.5 hour flight.
Yeah.
You know, so,
yeah.
But anyway, I'm really pleased to see, you know, some a whole lot of fiction coming from a part of the world where we have not previously enjoyed a lot of it, so this is exciting.
Yeah, I think that we're trying to shrug off the reputation of Australia being a sunny, happy, wonderful, friendly place, because we really have had some dark and grisly crimes across our history, and you know, it can be a terrifying place, and I think we just needed to recast it in that way, and people are discovering, oh, Australia does have a dark side. You know, and certainly some cinema that has come out in the last few years, like Wolf Creek, for example, has shown Australians. I don't know if Wolf Creek was big here or not, but Australians were horrified by it. We were like, that is so scary, because the premise is that you go into the outback and there are people there who live on the land who use it as their hunting ground, I suppose. And, you know, we had some notorious backpacker murderers and... another killing of a British man named Peter Falconio in the middle of the outback. You know, he and his girlfriend were just on a highway in the middle of nowhere where no one can hear you scream. And this guy pulled them over and just killed him and tried to take her. And, you know, I could just go on and on about Australian true crime and just all the vicious tales. So it's really good that the fiction writers are taking that and putting it into fiction.
Actually, the outback in the American West, there are so many parallels, you know, that I'm not surprised that that we are now adapting to it. And we're going to talk a little bit about Queensland, which is totally different.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask also, Candace, because this might not be familiar to you, you know, in America, the Mystery Writers of America have the Edgar Allan Poe Awards, shortened to the Edgars, and the British have their Dagger Awards, and the Canadians, which I truly love, they have their... what's his name? Arthur Ellis Award, named for the Canadian hangman. So the actual award is a, you know, which I think is less appealing than the Cartier Diamond Dagger, but there you are. But Australia has the Ned Kelly Award, which Candace has won twice, for best first novel, right?
Yeah.
And then for best novel.
So tell us
about Ned Kelly. Who's he?
He was an Australian bush ranger and really a terrible person. you know, he was... criminally versatile. You know, he was sort of a cattle rustler and a robber and a murderer and just an all-round scumbag. He got in an enormous shootout with police. And, you know, he wrote or supposedly wrote a big manifesto. He was just sort of a renegade. And, you know, the helmet that he wore in the shootout with the police, you know, that was supposed to... protect him from bullets with just the slit for eyes has become really iconic in Australian sort of folklore. But it's just so funny that enough distance from Ned Kelly across history has kind of made us love him. And in Australia, I'm not sure if it's the same in the US, but in Australia it's a lot like our politicians. When they're in power, we absolutely hate their guts. And then after a few years, we're like, oh, I remember this prime minister or whoever it was. But yeah, I was very surprised to win the Ned Kelly the first time and then to win it the second time, because I just felt like I arrived on the crime fiction writing scene in Australia and just burst out of obscurity. I didn't have sort of a background with any of the writers. Nobody knew me or anything. And then I just burst in there and won the debut. And
so what were the titles of the two books you won for?
So the first one was called Hades, and it was about an old, like an ex-criminal overlord who's retired, and in his retirement he starts up a business where he buys a landfill, and criminals come to him with bodies and he hides them in the landfill for a fee. And he lives in a little shack in the middle of the dump, and just all sorts of people arrive to have their problems solved by him. People call him Hades because he's the lord of the underworld. So he is probably everyone's favorite character in that trilogy. Hades, Eden, and Fall is the trilogy, which is published by Kensington. And the question that I get asked most frequently is, are there going to be any more of those? You know, because they were pre-Crimson Lake. I wrote Crimson Lake to take a break from that series. And the series was a lot more gothic, I think, than Crimson Lake. I sort of had my, when I was a teenager, I read a lot of Anne Rice. So I read them over and over and over. So I had these vampire leanings. So I wrote very gothic stories for those first three. So yeah, they've done really well. They're in 15 different languages. And some of the countries have changed the title. In Japan, Hades is actually it's a word that means reunion. A little used word for reunion, and it's in Hebrew and like all different languages. Fantastic.
Well, to complete my survey before we talk about Crimson Lake, I was sitting here remembering that the Australian authors that, back when I started the store almost 30 years ago, that we knew were Arthur Upfield, who wrote a lot of books, and they touched on the Aboriginal community in Australia.
Yeah.
And I think he wrote a lot of them in the 1930s, if I remember right. So, you know, they're really historical. And then Peter Corus, who won a lot of Ned Kelly Awards, and he wrote mostly about Sydney. Wasn't it a police procedural in Sydney?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he and I have the same agent. Uh-oh. So we see each other and things like that. Yeah. Yeah, he's cool. His stuff is really, really good. I think he's put down the pen finally after some obscene amount of books, like, I think like 50 or something.
Yeah, probably at least that many. Yeah. Yes. Now, he's written on and on and on. But for a long time, when you heard about the Ned Kelly Award, it was always Peter Corus winning it. So if you're looking for anything, you know, Australian that is perhaps a bit dated by now, then you can find it. I'm not sure the Arthur Upfields are in print in this country anymore. But when I went to Australia, I have a nephew that lives in Melbourne. And when my husband and I went to visit him, probably 15 years ago and so forth, when we went into bookshops, almost all of the fiction, the crime fiction, was American. It would be Michael Connelly and whatever. There was virtually nothing except Arthur Upfield or Cary Greenwood. Mm. So it's great that,
it's so great.
You know, and part of it, I think, is that publishing, a lot of it was controlled by London. And books were printed in England and shipped to Australia, which made them extremely expensive.
Yeah.
And now there are more publishers, Australian publishers, working in Australia, like Allen & Unwin or Pantera Press or whatever. And that makes a big difference, too, because the cost of books would really rock you if you went into a store in Australia or New Zealand. You would be truly surprised at the prices.
Yeah, and some of the smaller independent presses in Australia have taken a long time to take off, I think. There's one that asked me for a cover quote recently, and when I was trying to get published, I sought them out because they were very, very small and they had very limited titles and they didn't have any crime fiction at all. And I thought I could be your first one, you know. And they actually rejected me 12 months after Hades was first published. So I got the rejection letter and I was like, well, I'll actually tell you where you can go and buy it. but they've just started publishing crime. So it's taken them, you know, 5 years or something to get to expand out into.
Well, I just think it's all exciting. I know this is kind of a long deal, but since we haven't had a chance to talk about it, I thought it would be interesting. So let's talk about Crimson Lake, which is a really terrific book. It's our Surprise Me book club pick for March. And up against some, I might say, really stiff competition, one of whom was Christopher Rice, son of Ian Rice, who wrote a fabulous book called Bone Music. And another one next Wednesday, The Sandman by Lars Kepler, who are a husband and wife. Truly has the scariest serial killer since Hannibal Lecter, this guy Yurik, in this book is truly amazing. So if you're interested at all, come next Wednesday and we will talk about him. But you've got here, you've got two extremely interesting protagonists. But tell me first, why did you decide on North Queensland, which is swampy and full of crocodiles and, you know, kind of isolated.
It was an interesting choice. I lived in Queensland for 7 years. My mother was horrified by that because she had 4 kids and then adopted 2. And they all sort of lived within an hour of her in Sydney. And then I went to Queensland, which is like 12 hours drive away. And I stayed there for 7 years and she was just mortified by that. But I loved it up there because it was sinister in a different sort of way. Yeah. I grew up in Sydney and I grew up in the western suburbs of Sydney. And the crime is very visible, you know, you can, and the badness, I suppose, is very visible. You can see people on the corner or whatever and you're like, they, you know, they don't look bad. Or you're aware of the different areas where it might be dangerous.
Well, it's urban crime. It's urban.
But when I went to Queensland, there are, you know, warning crocodile, you know, warning Irukandji, don't swim anywhere. There's danger like beneath the surface, natural danger beneath the surface. And then you're driving through the cane fields and there are these little houses that, you know, are really broken and run down, and but they appear to have people living in them. Mm. And, you know, it's very... it's just eerie. There's an eeriness to it. And I thought this would be perfect. And Ted, the main person of this novel, he's sort of coming from Sydney and he is trying to go somewhere that he can disappear because he's accused of this terrible crime. And I thought Cairns, where it is set, would be absolutely perfect to disappear in because it's just so lush and full of life. When I was living there, you know, if you threw a handful of seeds out the window, 2 days later you'd have all sorts of plants. Like, it's so fertile up there. And a lot of the experiences that he has, like going outside and finding an enormous snake in the rafters of his porch, are experiences that I had. You know, and I just had to fend for myself. You know, you're living in the rainforest down a 5 kilometer track. And there's a stake in your rafters and you don't want it to be there, you've got to get it down by yourself and move it and learn how to do that. And it's just a sort of, Cairns is a kind of a magical place. You know, everything is bigger. You've got spiders as big as your hand and huge mosquitoes.
Is this the same Cairns where the Great Barrier Reef is off? Yeah. Because I've been there.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, my experience as a tourist staying in a resort in order to take my teenage daughter to dive in the Great Barrier Reef was nothing like the Cairns in this book. So I had to really think about it. In fact, I looked it up to see if there were actually 2 places named Cairns in Queensland.
Yeah, it's, you've got to get off the beaten track, I suppose. And when I was there, I went to this crocodile farm because I was so sick of seeing crocodile signs everywhere and not seeing any actual crocodiles. And so I went to this farm, which is an actual working farm where they harvest them, they grow them up, they harvest them. And it was so backward. The place is actually closed down now. But the guy would get in the enclosure with his crocodile and like lure it out of the water. It's just him. He's got like a dead chicken carcass and he's just luring this. It's as big as a car. It's coming out of the water slowly, dragging itself up. And he's going, Bruno, Bruno, trying to feed this thing. As a crime writer, I always ask the really unpopular questions. So I said to him, you must have some really interesting workplace accident stories from working here. And he was like, yeah, we'll let the tour go ahead. So everyone went ahead and I was standing with this guy. And he said, that crocodile, Bruno, one time somebody who worked there was doing that exact routine. And they would do, Bruno, Bruno, come on out of the water. And somebody asked a question and he turned around. And the crocodile just came up, took his whole arm off, in front of a tour group and everything. And the second story that he told me is that in a different enclosure, a crocodile had rushed out of the water really quickly and grabbed the guy and dragged him back in front of a kindergarten class, an entire kindergarten class who had all come, like on a school excursion, you know, and you just think to yourself, this is a wild place. You know, even the crocodiles that are in cages, in enclosures, you know, in proper zoos and things are dangerous. Like, it is a dangerous place.
Yes, I don't think you can tame a crocodile. I don't really believe that's one thing. It's not, you know, not a choice. Like, for example, an elephant. I mean, all animals, all wild, you know, they are dangerous in certain circumstances, but I didn't think that crocodiles lend themselves much to...
I think there are some pretty untamed people up there.
Well, no doubt, you know, but that's true. My friend Dana Stabenow, when we were talking about Alaska, once said, you know, the places like that attract people from the radical left and the radical right.
Yeah.
You know, genuinely rebellious people. Or in your case, somebody who wants to disappear.
Hmm.
And yet, you know, you've written him. He's been accused of doing something that he hasn't done, but he hasn't really got a great way to explain it. And it's almost like a kind of a Me Too thing in the sense that, you know, if you are accused and yet you're innocent, it's very difficult to prove it. So here he is. He's lost his family, and he's hiding out there. But I think Amanda is really interesting because she actually did do it.
Amanda is Ted's partner, and she... was
professional.
Very...
Wait, when you say partner.
Oh, yeah. So
let's not confuse partner and partner.
Yeah, no. So she fully admits to stabbing her high school friend to death when she was 17. So she's done her time. She's out and she has wrangled her way somehow to become a private investigator. And she was very difficult to write. She started off as a man in the manuscript, and he was very vampy, and it just wasn't working. And so I did a gender swap, and I really thought about what I was trying to do. I think I was trying to do something like Lisbeth Salander from The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, but so somebody has social problems and empathy problems, but I didn't want somebody who was really like dark and moody. I wanted someone cheerful and who just thinks that they're hilarious. And, you know, and so I built her one block at a time. She is only fully formed probably into the next novel, into Redemption Point, which is the sequel. And I was learning about her as I went. You know, one of the things that Amanda does is she makes up rhymes. So she's constantly rhyming things, and it's really annoying when she thinks it's hilarious. And one of the things about me is that I think I'm hilarious, and my husband points out to me sometimes, you know, how hilarious I think I am. And I was in a liquor store with him, and there were these limes sitting in a basket on the counter. And I said to my husband, do you know what time it would be if I stole those? It would be prime time for lime crime. And he was like, wow. Like, that really wasn't funny. And I was laughing my ass off. And so, you know, I thought that could be a part of Amanda. That could be one of the things that she does.
Are you Cockney by inheritance?
No.
Because that's what Cockneys do. You know, Cockney rhyming slang
is in fact
why they speak the way they do and have all these odd terms for things. It's a whole a whole form of communication for them. So I wonder, since some of them were transported to your country, that maybe that would be...
I actually know very little about my personal history. We had somebody in our family, my grandmother's grandfather, I think, he was a professional dingo catcher. So he would go around the country if people had a nuisance dingo that was coming into the town and killing dogs and cats and just hanging around and being scary. He would be the one to trap it and catch it.
Is a dingo an Australian version of the coyote?
Yeah.
Or is it more like a hyena?
No, it's a lot like a coyote. I have been in the U.S., in California, in particular, since July, and I have been looking everywhere for a coyote. And my husband and I are in the Hollywood Hills, and everyone's like, "Have you seen a coyote yet? Have you seen a coyote?" And we were waiting, watching. We got up at dawn because we heard that we see them at dawn, looking everywhere. We bought binoculars to put in the car, and then we're driving along. This one walking across the car park of a golf course, like it owns the place, and we're just driving along. We're like, "Oh, coyote!" You know, just
we have one that walks around the circle in our neighborhood. You know, he strolls about, or she, as the case may be. I haven't gotten close enough to look, but we have a lot of coyotes here. Since, and you know, their habitat has been invaded, they are often to be found, you know, coming in because we've intruded. Yeah,
I'm looking out for a desert tortoise. I've seen one in a reptile shop, but I haven't seen one on the move.
They have an excellent zoo in Tucson called, what's it called? The Desert? It's not called a zoo. It's the Desert Something Museum.
Sonoran Desert.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. That is it. The Sonoran Desert Museum. Hmm. And you actually, I think, kind of go past it on the freeway, but it's not a zoo. Well, it is a zoo, but a kind of unconventional zoo.
Yeah.
But it would be well worth your
checking it out.
So we have your two people, Amanda and...
Mm. And Ted. Yeah.
And Ted. Mm. And what brings them together?
Well, it's Ted's accusation, I suppose, and his lawyer sort of suggests that Amanda might be the only person in town willing to put up with him, you know, because he has to work. He's on the edge of the lake, listening to the crocodiles barking at night, living in this dilapidated house, drinking whiskey. Like, he needs help. He rescues a family of geese, and he's just living there with his geese, and his lawyer says to him, I think you should maybe hook up with Amanda. And their partnership works because it shouldn't. I suppose that's what I've always done when I write. I put two people together who really shouldn't be together, and then I watch them, you know, or write them in their banter. In the Bennett Archer series, you have Frank, who's a knockabout Aussie cop, and his partner, Eden, who is a beautiful, majestic, very vampy woman, and she's a serial killer by night, and his only sense of worth really is in being a cop. So the two of them don't really fit together, you know, and that's what works. I get really insanely bored when I read crime fiction novels and everyone gets on great and everyone fits together and everyone's in mind meld, you know. I really need that friction to keep me interested. It was fun to write. Part of the novel is actually built on a true crime that happened. So Ted is accused of abducting a young girl from a bus stop, and there was a young boy who was abducted from a bus stop in Queensland. He was on his way to buy Christmas presents for his family from the local mall, and someone abducted him, and it was 14 years before they found his killer. But for those 14 years, the major lead that the police had was this blue car that was sighted at the scene, and it was a busy highway. Something like 75 people testified to having seen this blue car by the side of the road while the boy was there, you know. It was gone minutes after, you know, and the police actually constructed a blue car room that it was really their only lead for this incredible amount of time. And it turned out when they found his killer that the blue car had nothing to do with it. The killer was driving a white four-wheel drive, and he went up and parked behind some trees. So that blue car probably was there because so many people saw it, and I imagine that whoever that was who owned that car, who was there for whatever reason, maybe pulled over to take a phone call or whatever, just for those 14 years must have just been lying awake every night and thinking, should I tell them it was me and that I was there? Like, what if they pin it on me? I'm their only lead, you know, and it's in the newspaper, this blue car, look out for the blue car. And I can't imagine that person's life. They never found whoever it was, but.
A real life red herring.
Yeah.
Scary.
Yeah.
Well, I thought the book moved along really well, and there's a very nice lead-in, so I'm happy to hear that you've already mentioned there's a second book called Redemption Point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's exciting. So tell us a little bit about, since tomorrow we will be talking about 50-50, which is your second Harriet Blue book with James Patterson. How did you and James get together?
Oh, it was funny. I had written three books. You know, I was still trying to get my name out in Australia, and I was invited to this cocktail party that he was hosting, you know, overlooking Sydney Harbour. And I just thought, oh my God, I'm going to go and meet James Patterson. And I'd been reading James Patterson since I was a little kid, you know, inappropriately early. I had been sneaking into my mum's room and reading James Patterson's. And I thought, I just want to have my fan moment with him, you know. So I dressed in the nines and I got my hair done. I spent like $300 getting my hair done. So I was like, no matter what happens, I need him to see my hair. And I just I just, like, he came in and there's 150 people there and everyone just went, oh my God, there he is, don't look, you know. And he was being introduced to all these very important people. And I just thought, he's never going to get introduced to me. They're not going to bring him around here eventually. I'm going to have to go over there. So I just crashed in over there. Like, I was like, oh, sorry, excuse me, you know. I'm just going to duck in there and quickly say hello. And I tapped him on the shoulder and I just said, oh, James, I'm so glad you're here. I'm a crime writer, and I think that part of the reason that I write crime is because, you know, I read your books when I was a kid.
You just wanted to show off your $300 hair. Come on.
Oh, I was gauging the light on how it would best reflect my full head of highlights. And then I said to him, I read Kiss the Girls when I was 12 years old, and I absolutely loved it. And he hadn't said anything at this point. I'd just been blathering, and he goes, well, that's kind of inappropriate, you know, for you to have read it when you were 12, because if you've read Kiss the Girls, it's really, you know, it's heavy lifting. And so we were just chatting and that sort of thing. And my publisher saw us chatting from across the room, and she said, oh, you went and chatted to him. Is he nice? She was trying to get up the courage to go and say hello as well. And I said, yeah, he's lovely, you know. And so she put a copy of Hades in a book pack for him to take home, of like, these are our Aussie authors that we're proud of, sort of thing. And he read it on the plane home to Florida. And he really loved it, I guess, because he called up, you know, like a week later, and he said, do you think she would want to collaborate with me? And then they called me and they said, do you think you would want to collaborate with James Patterson?
And you, like, said no.
Oh, I'm going to need some time to think about it, you know. Pretty busy, you know. I was ecstatic, absolutely ecstatic, because I never imagined anything like that. All I ever wanted was one book published once, and then suddenly you turn around and your book's being printed in Hebrew, and you're writing with James Patterson, and you're doing German book tours and all sorts of stuff. Like, it just exploded into this thing that I never imagined that it could ever be.
So tell us about Harriet Blue, who's the lead character.
Yeah, well, we sort of built her brick by brick as well. James said, like, started her off easy. He kind of said, I want a book set in Australia, but not necessarily like in a much metropolitan centre, because it had already sort of done that with Private Sydney and Private Oz. And he said, I want a strong male protagonist. And I was like, okay. And I said, well, in terms of setting, here are some ideas. And I had been reading some articles about fly in, fly out mines in the middle of the desert. You know, and so I said, what about one of those? And I was in the Navy for 2 years when I was younger. And so I said, what about a Navy ship and this sort of thing? And he said, oh, tell me about these FIFO mines. And then I said, I'm really interested in people who discover that they have a killer in the family, and like, what is that like to reconcile someone you're related to being a killer? And he said, oh, wouldn't it be interesting if it was a brother and sister pair? Let's make the protagonist female. And then Harriet sort of struggles with her growing up in foster care. So my mum had 4 kids, like I said, and she adopted 2, but she actually fostered over 150 kids across my childhood. So I'm well versed in what foster kids are like and the circumstances that bring you in them into your life. Like, some of my earliest memories are police in the kitchen dropping off some kids whose parents have just been arrested, and they get dropped at our house. And you know, so my mum had 6 permanent kids, and then she could have up to 6 more at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So the house was like just crazy.
A dormitory.
Yeah, like a dormitory, yeah, or a daycare centre, you know, which made me not very popular at high school, you know, because I was turning up with these high school foster kids who very traumatized, sometimes very badly behaved, this sort of thing. Mm. And then there were so many kids that my mum, she didn't have a normal car. She had a minibus. And then my family was notorious for taking in injured wild animals as well. So whenever there was like an education day or something at school, oh, we need to teach them about kangaroos. Oh, we'll see if my family has one, and bring in a kangaroo and that sort of stuff. So kind of like this freak family.
Well, you had plenty of material to work
with. You know,
with.
Yeah. So that's where the fostering sort of came about. We just sort of worked from there. Yeah, yeah. I don't know how she ended up so violent, because she will kick you in the face and then ask questions later, sort of thing.
Not your orthodox police person.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, not definitely not. She has a real hair trigger, and but I guess her personality just evolved from the situations that we kept putting her in.
So 50-50 is the second one. What was the first one?
The first one was called Never Never. That one was set in a FIFO mine. Sorry. The second one is where Harriet's trying to clear her brother's name.
Right. Her brother Sam.
Yeah, and so part of that is set in Sydney, and part of it is set in a small town called Last Chance Valley, which is sort of in the outback. And then we actually have a third workout, which is called Black and Blue. It's one of those little bookshots.
Mm-hmm.
So that is around, and that's a prequel to Never Never, before Harriet discovers that her brother has been arrested.
So are you planning on writing another Harriet Blue, or was that...
The next one is written.
Oh, okay.
It's in copy edit now.
Wonderful.
And then the next one after that, I mean, James and I have talked about it, but we haven't done the whole working with him. The first thing we do is we construct an enormous plan. So we haven't done that yet. But it's going to go on, hopefully, for ages, because, I mean, I'm having a great time doing it. So
you're going to be able to write those and then write your own series. And,
yeah. So I have been writing two books a year. And this year I'm going to do three for the first time. My agent said to me, working with James's people and some of the publishers and that, do you think you could do three this year? And I said, I'll give it a red hot go.
I see that being in the Navy probably was good for you. Lots of discipline there.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, well, that's wonderful.
I write very fast. So, yeah.
Well, I am going to sign off on our little podcast here.
Sure.
And then...